Welcome to The Burnout Show, a weekly conversation with special guests who generously share their burnout stories with us. We also chat with health and wellness experts on how to best navigate burnout when you're in the thick of it, as well as how to avoid it returning. And now here's your host, Jess Jones.
Hi there, and welcome back to The Burnout Show. Before we get into today's chat with Helen Hannison, I just wanted to remind you that if you are struggling with burnout and need some extra support, the Breaking Up with Burnout mini course is available now. You'll get access to 3 modules that cover life, work, and burnout, which you can move through at your own pace. Head to the link in our show notes to find out more, or go to theburnoutclub.com/breakingupwithburnout. I hope you enjoy today's chat with Helen Hannison. Thanks again for listening. Let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of The Burnout Show. Today's special guest is Helen Hannison. Helen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Really pleased to be here.
Thank you for your time. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, sure. These days, I'm a leadership coach and executive coach. So what I do is help usually quite seasoned professionals, certainly committed careerists who feel stuck at some kind of career crossroads and really worried about that and stuck in a cycle of trying to solve their career problem on their own. So what we do together is make a fresh plan so they realign work they love with the life they wish they were living and then know how to act on that so they can finally make aligned, confident transformation happen instead.
Sounds powerful, and I've got many questions about that. But first, I just want to ask you what you wanted to be when you were growing up.
Yeah, this is really an interesting question. I think there are probably some people who would say, oh, well, I wanted to be, you know, a princess or an astronaut or, you know, something. And I don't think I ever really knew a specific anything. I think I wanted to be, I was very much into my book. So the nearest I could get to is I'd like to be a writer, as in an author. And I sort of fantasized about that sometimes, but haven't quite given birth to a book yet.
Yeah, I'm sure it's down the track for you. Plenty to write about now.
Yes, so there is that.
In your role in helping people in these, I guess, these paths that they've chosen for themselves that are quite demanding, you know, they've got big expectations of themselves, probably external pressures as well to succeed. Have you seen some commonalities in the types of people that are striving for these big goals?
Well, you know, while I could say yes, actually, I feel like it's really important to tease out some of the psychology, and that's my background, so it's kind of my go-to. But if you look at the research that's sort of come out and more in recent years, then actually what they seem to point at is that it isn't a particular personality or you know, typology of person or the demands of the workplace and deadlines and pace of work either. What it is the interaction of the two. So I feel like when I'm asked about commonality, it's that, and it's really important to point out that means it's therefore universal. Any of us could tip into a career context that we're just so, I guess, committed and striving so hard to achieve or to prove. So it's why it often happens for people, or they're sort of on the brink of burnout when they start a new role, because it, you know, you kind of have that feeling that it's so important to get established in that role, and you kind of can't breathe easy until, you know, leadership says, you know, you've really had a great impact here. So I think there's a lot going on there. And I think it's probably a mix, quite a toxic mix of toxic productivity, fast pace and high expectations, but not just from others, by others imposed on you, but of yourself as well, and bringing that pressure to it. So I think if I have to answer, if I really was forced to give a word, I'd sort of say ambitious people. Yeah. I've forgotten it's ambitious to thrive. It's just ambitious to succeed.
Yes, that's right. And there is
that makes sense.
Do you think some people are born leaders?
Ooh, that's another good one, isn't it? No, actually. And I I quite like the idea that although some of us will have natural traits that predispose us, actually it's an awful lot about environment. And what that means is if you've got strong leaders in, you know, as you're growing up, and it could be your family, it could be teachers, it could be early career and that career building phase, you know, you can model after them, and that certainly makes it easier. But I do also think, being a leadership coach, that you can also teach these things. And, you know, if I can teach it, then it also means anyone can learn. Sure. So I quite often talk about speaking up or speaking out, you know, how to have difficult conversations, because I find that's one of the most challenging points for people who are newly promoted into leadership roles. And it can feel a bit precarious, and people find, I think, sometimes that they flounder at that point instead of flourish when they're sort of moved away from the operational side of that thing they do to instead being in charge of the bottom line of the team, you know, who are more hands-on now with the implementation. And it means there's some tough conversations that have to be had with people you perhaps thought of as friends not that long before. So I know that there's a sequence of steps that you can teach and that people can learn to sort of really get some traction on that kind of, you know, leadership learning curve. So yeah, I'd like to say we're not born. It's something that we can grow, cultivate.
Yeah, and there is a real distinction between management and leadership. And I think for someone that aspires to be a leader, and then, as you said, actually stepping into that role, and that those dynamics completely shifting from that of working with your colleagues or managing a team to actually leading a team. There is definitely a big gap between those positions, and it must be hard for some people to make that transition and understand there's a new level of respect and I guess the relationships that they once thought they knew, they need to then sort of change and adjust to that new setting and that new role for them to be seen as a leader.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's kind of a, not exactly a reinvention. I think sometimes it's easier for people when they do reinvent because they've moved company, or at least department, you know. But I think otherwise it's more of a recalibration, and it is hard. It is hard to command the credibility with people who used to be peers. So, and I think often the people first kind of companies that they're the only companies I will work with, will often be looking for that credibility to be sort of a naturally already bought in by the peers before the elevation will take place. It's one of the markers of success. And I kind of respect that, because while the individual might feel like they're waiting a beat and, you know, they've got the skills up, this can be a bit frustrating. On the other hand, there's something about that maturity and the leadership, the emergent leadership, that is enormously important, I think, to whether they then thrive in the elevated role or not. Yes, so it's an important time, that recalibration.
So what are some of the challenges that people will face when they are making that transition? What are some of the things that you help people the most with?
Yes, I think the most challenging thing whenever we, you know, have an environment change, and I would include getting promoted in the same place even, is that it can prompt new ways to deal with old pressures, but that only works if they're familiar. So what happens is, I think people are sort of catapulted out of the role that they've been promoted because they were excellent at, and they haven't necessarily always been given training ahead of time on the new skill set they're going to need and how to manage through that, that time of change. And I think that's really important to help people understand, in this new landscape, then what's the sort of updated vision? You know, if we hit refresh, what is it that you're aiming for in the next, you know, let's say 3 years? People, it's sort of a bit hard sometimes to go too far ahead, but when you've really consolidated in this position and you're ready for your next career growth, what would that look like? Because then if you can see it in hindsight instead, then you can start to fit micro steps towards the kind of growth and consolidation that you know you want for yourself. And that helps. And I think unless you take the time to consider that and be very intentional about the support that you lean into, that you ask to be put in place, and that's all part of inner leadership, saying, these are my needs, and you know, they're not luxuries, they're critical, then I think that can work really well, and you see a sort of a flourishing where otherwise it's a risk and it's a surprising one for everyone concerned if you see a floundering just as you're promoting someone. So I think for me, that's probably the most important thing. I think the other one is people often feel like there's an order to these things of success in our careers, that we need to act first. And again, the psychology tells us actually when it comes to self-regulation, when we're trying to attain a goal of any sort, it's the opposite. It's motivation needs to come first.
Mm.
So I think sometimes we get this stuff a bit wrong and we sort of go in the wrong order and wonder why it's not working.
Yeah.
But I think it's the common thread is be intentional. Take time to apply methodical thought, and then you can be intentional about what you do to support what you want.
Yeah. You mentioned a new landscape. How has it been trying to coach people in leadership roles or to leadership roles when we've also been experiencing the challenges of a pandemic the past 18 months?
Well, I feel like the word unprecedented almost got worn out, but yes. it's another time to use it, isn't it? It's, I think, been incredible. And it wasn't ever so long ago that burnout was recognised, you know, officially, as it were, for the first time. And I think that was good progress and not before time, because through the pandemic, I have to say, the coaching just went deeper, and it was right. It needed to, because not just of the obvious uncertainties, people were unsure whether, you know, their role was stable, but a lot of the time there were some positives that fell from that uncertainty, I think. You know, there was less scrutiny for careerists who knew they're unhappy and want to do something about that, so they could take the time to really put proper thought and give proper attention to this brain teaser of, you know, what should I change? You know, what is, you know, am I stuck doing that thing I've always done? How would I, you know, for people whose roles have been obliterated, how do I replace what I've lost? Or is it right to replace what I've lost? Is it time for a professional pivot? What transferable skills are there? So it was an awful lot. I almost imagine it swirling around people as I'm talking to them. But the other thing that I really noticed, and this wasn't just for careerist mothers, but I particularly picked up on it when I'm coaching. Well, I shouldn't just say mothers, actually, because I coach men as well. But, you know, it was the parents, particularly of younger children, younger school age even, who were suddenly homeschooling at the same time as running their full-time work. And I think there was a sort of burnout fatigue around the world. You know, I really felt I could put a date on it almost for the first few months. The leadership and employers of the world were, you know, very good about leaning into this whole new flexibility as long as the work gets done and, you know, mental well-being matters. And then it came to a point where actually the deadlines are the deadlines. So we need the work to be done. And if we're straddling time zones, oh, well. And if you're juggling children, well, we can't do much about that, can we?
Yeah.
And it all sort of, there was like an expiry date. So it was hard to watch, actually, really committed careerists who were finding that, you know, the division between work and outside work was literally non-existent, sometimes perched on the end of their bed, or if they were lucky, then, you know, their office was the dining room table or kitchen table. You know, it was very, very difficult blurring of what's personal and what's professional that I think is a horrible fast track to burnout. It really, really was, or could be.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're still seeing it in different parts of the world still. I'm in Melbourne in Australia and we're in our sixth lockdown currently. And there's definitely a different feeling this time around and people are exhausted. It's like everyone's burnt out and just a lot flatter, I think, in general. And a lot of other things happening in the world right now as well that are putting an extra level of heaviness on people, it seems. So it's definitely been challenging at times, especially for those that are managing, you know, kids as well, homeschooling, home kinder, all of the fun things. So it is tricky. Have you seen any particular personality traits that you believe help people, I guess, sort of stay in it a bit longer, have that persistence or that ability to just keep pushing and get themselves through? Or is it a matter of compartmentalizing almost or being in denial of those external factors that are happening around them and completely disconnecting from the fact that they have to parent at the same time or that they're working out of their bedroom and they've got housemates or, you know, those other factors as well?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I don't think there's any easy answer. We'd have to do like a whole podcast series, I think, to answer this one properly. But I think the trait, if I have to boil it down to one, I think the trait is interesting. You said persistence. I think it's perseverance. Mm. I'd call it resilience. I think it's that trait. Mm. But I do think it has a shadow side. So on the one hand, what I've been observing for sure is that people who are, you know, very tunnel vision, they have the ability to, you know, really hold focus on their workflow, on the team that are perhaps around them or supporting them or they're working into, whatever it may be, somehow can keep driving their behavior as committed careerists that they are. And that really powers them through until it doesn't. Because the problem is, I think, that resilience can also go wrong. And I think in seasoned professionals in particular, I feel like I see them, you know, grappling or tussling with these competing priorities at times. And it's almost a surprise. I sometimes think that we are surprised by how emotive things in our career feel, whereas we expect our most important relationships outside of work to have that kind of weight. But then, you know, we're not quite sure what to do within it when it shows up connected to our work. And I think that's what I start to see, that the resilience moves to the shadow side and actually turns into keeping people trapped, coping positively with a straight status quo that actually isn't healthy for them or isn't tenable long term, perhaps, or worse. And I think it's horribly contagious, because if you know leadership are humans too, even bad bosses are flawed humans as well. So I think if you think of the potential for that kind of stress being as protracted as it has and cascading down. That's and of right. course it's contagious. So yeah, I think that is resilience, and that comes with a health warning for sure.
Mm. Yeah. I guess given the work you do, you would see a lot of people, you know, as you said, sort of flourish and thrive in their roles and others not so much. When you're doing this work yourself, and obviously with a psychology background as well, are there things that you recognize in yourself that you have been able to then share with other people to help them?
Yes, I do. I think so. I think when we're in a super engaged mindset, and I think the reason that I referred earlier to this idea of just as you start, you know, a new position, probably a promoted position, if we're honest, that most of us will move for that elevation, not the fulfillment, although we tell ourselves it's about the culture or, you know, the commute to work's better or whatever it was.
Yeah.
I think something happens in that super engaged mindset. And actually, I think it's sometimes the younger career builders who have that kind of energy and drive to not just do their work, but think of everything they do around it as defining them. So their career, but perhaps they're also, you know, wanting, pursuing a non-exec position over there, or they're doing some volunteering here because they know it will serve them later in their career to demonstrate those other touch points and sort of be more rounded. And I think for people in that mindset, what I see is that that career focus is like proof points to their value as a human. And that's the bit that I think I do recognize about my past self. My past pre-pivot was a 20-year tour of duty in the world's largest PR firms. And I, you know, I definitely felt at points that what I did, you know, absolutely defined me. And I think I recognize, with the benefit of hindsight, that, you know, that's not a healthy perspective. It's not a tenable perspective, but it's also really useful. And this is a question I ask quite often in the coaching, is who is driving that behavior? Because that was me driving that behavior in my story, for sure. It was, it was that sense of self and identity that felt like it was in crisis if the client or the campaign or the team was in crisis or having to troubleshoot. So there's a really important distinction to be made. And I think that's just, I couldn't emphasize it enough, really, that it isn't ever the in down to the individual or down to the work demands, the workflow, the deadlines. It is the interaction of the two. So we're back to this idea of somehow step back, zoom out, get a bit of a helicopter view somehow on what are you feeling pressed to do and who is pushing you to, you know, behave in, you know, to that level of commitment, and is it really serving you? And I think once you start asking that question or those questions, people usually sort of stop, you know, as if they're rabbit in headlights and sort of like, interesting, wow, actually that's not a straightforward, it's being done to me. And as soon as you realize that, you're at choice. You can change.
Do you think that that way of thinking or that drive comes from something that's been part of your childhood that's wanted you to, you know, in other episodes we've spoken about seeking that external validation or approval or visibility because, you know, people didn't get it when they were younger? Do you think that's a big part of why people just throw themselves in and completely define themselves by the work they do?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. I would also say it can be the opposite. It's people who feel they have been brought up on a diet of achieving and succeeding and then need to keep creating it in order to almost feed a self-esteem monster. And I think there, you know, there's another distinction there about, you know, in if we do live with that kind of self-esteem, external validation, you're only ever as good as the last achievement, right? You know, you need to keep it. It's quite precarious, actually. And those, you know, people who live in that cycle are probably pretty harsh with themselves when there is a misstep or a setback or, you know, heaven forbid, a fail. You know, they will take a while to stop punishing themselves, actually, and get back on track. Whereas somebody who can employ some self-kindness and self-compassion because they've had that demonstrated in their past instead will actually repair quicker and get back on track quicker because they're not quite so dependent on the outside other's affirmation or approval or the markers of success, the promotion, the pay rise, the shiny new car, the holiday, whatever it may be.
I think
either way, the answer is that our past shapes our future approaches to things, and that's really what we're talking about.
You said you would have this conversation with people and they would recognize that there was a choice and that they were, you know, part of the problem, but part of what was presented to them in this fight for success and achievement and being fueled by this need to succeed in their roles. So at what point does someone say, oh, okay, I've got a choice here, and recognize that they've been doing that and then make the change? And how would they go about making those changes?
So there's a different answer for everyone. For me, the coaching has been built on very much sort of one-to-one bespoke coaching. And although I do now have an online course, because people kept asking me for that, what I find is amazing is that you can spot in someone's narrative when they're talking to you. And I'm a narrative therapist as well as a leadership coach. So I sort of bring that to the coaching, and always asking people to tell me stories and anecdotes, bring it to life, what they're experiencing, what is the origin story to this feeling? What is this pattern of behavior or this response to something that's going on in their career? Where is that coming from? Does it relate to something in their past? And as soon as people can start to see, oh, so the problem story is separate from me, the person, that's the moment that they understand they're at choice. And from there, it's actually not that hard, although it's also not instant, to help people pivot to a new storyline. They can literally rewrite the next career chapter if they can notice those triggers for themselves. It helps often to understand where it tracks back to, or at least think of an example in your past so that you can recognize it. Because then you can look to your preferred story and literally put behaviors and tactics and techniques and tools in place so that you get to act or live into that preferred story. And it's that combination of the thought patterns, the behavioral responses that attracts the different result. And that's making change happen. So the reason I say there's a moment in time where everything clicks into place. But I don't want to mislead the work then to fall out of an entrenched habit and move into a preferred one takes time and commitment. So it's that's where the hard work is, but it's entirely possible. And I think what I do notice is when people even begin, they tentatively start in their real world to respond differently when something presents itself that would have been triggering before that kind of conversation together. They notice the world responds differently to them immediately. It's almost, really, that's the bit that's instant for them. And that's, of course, a really great reinforcement to keep going and get bolder. And, you know, in time, it becomes much more automatic.
Must be incredibly powerful seeing that change.
Do you know, it really is. I had someone email me last week and say, I'm almost astonished. She was updating me on a scenario where actually there'd been some, you know, really quite fierce discrimination in the workplace that she had submitted to silently for a long time and was addressing. And part of it was pivoting to a new narrative and understanding why she had submitted silently and thought that she had no choice. So it was a very empowering process. It was also a confronting process. Make no mistake, it wasn't an easy one. So to hear her say, I can't believe I prepared like this, I delivered the message like that, and this was the response. I am amazed how the world responded to me, and, you know, I got the result I needed. And that, I just literally have no words, do I? So I don't often stop, pause for thought, but it very, very powerful for sure.
So I'd imagine it must be, it's quite a lot of responsibility for yourself to be managing all these people and these feelings and these emotions and their growth and their expectations and their big goals. So how do you look after yourself, and what does your own self-care look like?
You know, it's a really important point, actually. I will always have high investment in my clients, and particularly those I work with one-to-one, because you know, we get to know each other on obviously a very deep level. But the coach training I did with CTI, Coach Leadership Training Institute, was very, very careful, very rigorous, actually, about teaching this point. It is high investment work, but it's low attachment. So I'm asking questions, and it mustn't matter to me whether I'm spot on with what I think is going on for the person, or whether actually getting it wrong is part of what helps them course correct and say, no, that's not quite me. I mean it more like this, or I wouldn't want that. I would want the other. And that's really a thread that it just couldn't be more important to hold on to. So that is one piece within the moment in the coaching.
Yeah.
I think self-care more generally is what I talk to other people about. You wake up in the morning, and maybe the night before, maybe that morning, you sort of decide what is the most important thing, maybe two, and you focus, and you know, you hold that kind of clarity with you through the day, and you have realistic expectations, and you manage your own expectations about how much you can do, and you check in with yourself and notice when it, you know, I know through the pandemic, I felt more called to support more people. And of course, in some ways, we had more time, so it worked. But there was a most definite line. And it was really important for me as a coach to say, okay, I can see that the impact that I have on other people, which is my priority, making a difference, is more important to me than how many people I impact. And I think it's a really important distinction for all of us to make when we say we want to, you know, contribute or leave a legacy or make a difference. What does that mean? Because to some people it means global world domination and, you know, or enormous, you know, pound signs and dollar signs in the bank. And to others, it means having a deep impact on one individual at a time. For me, that's what it is. So it's always noticing what is being a self-expert, what is going on. Yeah. And I think that way, when you're clear about your values, you can then tweak and refine and finesse quite quickly. So sometimes progress looks a bit like a zigzag. It's not linear, because you'll have noticed something and then think, oh, no, that's not quite right. And then zigzag over there to correct that piece, and on it goes. So I think it's that agile mindset, really. And that works for me and helps others, I know, as well.
Yeah. So you do actually practice what you preach.
Oh, yes. I mean, I think there is a purist school of coaching where you just ask your powerful questions and don't bring any of yourself to the sessions. But I would feel almost disingenuous if I didn't experience myself or had experience of something I believed would help someone I'm working with and somehow keep it secret. That wouldn't work for me at all. So, yes, yeah, absolutely.
That's good. Yeah. What brings you joy?
Do you know, I think it is this feeling of making a difference. I would say if I had to rank my own values, it's probably that right up the top. And I don't think it is in a sort of leaving a legacy way. I think it's more of a collection of breadcrumbs. It doesn't need to be a seismic shift, but it has to be a significantly felt change, that feeling of making a difference to someone. Emotional intelligence or mindset mastery, as I call it often, is that somehow helping them cultivate an incredible self-belief and then achieve things because they've got that now. And it's that. I do think it's that. And that's outside of my work and in my work. It's just sort of running through me like a stick of rock, really.
Yeah, amazing. Is there anything that keeps you up at night, good or bad?
Yes, I usually blame the teenagers for keeping me up at night. I think it's just there's something going on about a future focus when there's a reason to worry. I think it's sometimes, and I do think I bet this about anxiety generally, it's really quite useful if you can work it out, because it's the only emotion that is about something that hasn't happened yet. So if you can puzzle out exactly what it is that you're anxious about, is keeping you up at night, then you actually have a chance to put some solutions or, you know, whatever in place to preempt that thing. So for me, it's usually the intense worry. And actually, as we record this, both my kids are about to go back to school, a new year, it's a new school for one. And it, for me, it's that stuff. It's you're just anticipating things that may or may not ever happen, and worrying on behalf of somebody else usually, because therefore you can't control it. Where actually I think I have the self-efficacy. If it's something happening for me, I think, okay, well, this is how I know I must deal with this.
Yeah.
But it's that slight feeling of not being able to control it, because we can't control someone who isn't us.
Yes.
That's what keeps me up at night.
Yeah. And what are you most grateful for right now?
Oh, do you know, I think this is going to sound really cheesy. I had a bit of a horrible health hiccup in 2020. So I'm going to say I am so grateful for my health. For in some ways, life is a bit frustrating still with the pandemic. But for me, because of that health context, I actually feel grateful that, you know, I've been able to sort of, it's almost pop back to the surface is how it feels, and get on with the things that matter to me most.
Mm.
So it's that engagement, real engagement with what matters to me in my life, people, work, my coaching clients, you know, it's really quite a small little constellation of things that became incredibly clear, but it all wraps up in good health and that aliveness, I think is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, wonderful. If there was one piece of advice or one tip you could give someone today who's going through burnout themselves, what would it be?
I think it would be to know your values, and not just a whole list of 20 or 10 even, you know your top two or three values, those things that, you know, matter to you most, that you really stand for in a way you can't not have, and have absolute clarity. Because when you're asked to work against those values, that's when burnout sort of comes for you. So for me, that kind of clarity allows you to realign a plan so your work reflects or expresses those things that matter to you most, but it's also like your early warning system. You know, then really quickly, it doesn't grow slowly within you. It's an instant, that's a boundary that's been crossed. And now I know how to reset it, because I cannot and will not be able to live with that. And you speak up. And as soon as we do that, we have, you know, we get rewarded for the agency that we're using, and something happens. Now, I can't always promise the right solution, because it may be sometimes for some people the right thing is to leave the situation if it's untenable, but it becomes clear quickly. So you're in control, and that's an autonomous choice. So yeah, to me, that's hugely important. And I'm going to be ever so happy to offer your audience a framework that I use with my clients to help them when we do that work, and that make that available to them.
Thank you. I absolutely love that response. It's not like anything I've heard before. And I think the reason I love it so much is because we often talk about values and knowing what they are and understanding them, and understanding that sometimes they may change slightly over time in different stages of your life. But there's definitely some power in recognizing what they are and then making decisions each day based on those values. And then that comes into play with your work, with your relationships, with your friendships, with everything that you do, really. So I think it's a really important point to, you know, check in and see, first of all, do you know what they are? Because some people haven't done this work before. And others have done it, but their values may have slightly changed over time. So it's understanding what they are as a very starting point, and then using those as a way to check in with yourself along the way before you get to that burnout point, as you mentioned.
Yeah, totally. It's interesting. Values are, I mean, they are, we're familiar with the word, aren't we? But I think if you ask people what are their top values, there's sort of two camps. People will either come up with, like I say, loads of socially desirable qualities or traits that they aspire to, don't necessarily live to, or that it's a conversation stopper. They don't know. And I get that, because values, unlike strengths, they operate under the surface, under the consciousness, and they do shift on top of that. So, they, you know, it isn't easy. It really isn't easy, is it? But it takes, you know, there's some tools and techniques that help you unpack that sort of, yeah, what's going on at the core. And I think, yeah, you're right. As soon as you have that clarity, then you can tie actions and tactics to it. And that's actually why values are so valuable. It's not knowing them. It's living into them, every day. Yeah. Makes sense.
Amazing. Helen, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. If you're suffering from burnout or want some tips on how to avoid it, join our Facebook group, the Burnout Club Community. If you've gotten something out of today's episode, we'd love your review. Simply click the link in the show notes to share your thoughts. Until next time, go gently.